Okay, welcome. As you all finish your dinner and your awesome conversations about how great today was, and which we've been eavesdropping on, I'm stepping back in to get our last panel of the day started. This is the panel. It's a little bit of a looser panel. We've called it. I originally called it cultural polarization, which is not a great name. But really, what we wanted to do was make sure that we're not leaving out of the conversation some of the issues that came up today that are really about things that make it difficult for government to function that aren't necessarily located within government itself, that have to do with deeper cultural trends, attitudes in the media, public attitudes about government, demographics, and really in history, that will help us understand how we got to where we are. So all I'm going to do right now is introduce the moderator of this panel, Nicole Austin Hillary, who is the director of the Washington, D.C. office of the Brennan Center, and she will moderate this panel and introduce the fabulous people on stage here.
Thank you. And isn't it appropriate that the Washington director is the one to moderate this particular panel, given our discussion today? Thank you all again for being here with us today. I have a wonderful group of people here with me. And just so you know, I know that you all have been listening to wonderful discussions today, and it's all been very intense. This is going to be, as my aerobics instructor says, the cool down. This is going to be your opportunity to really hear some interesting conversation. It's going to be smart conversation, but it's going to be conversational. We don't want you to hear speeches. We want you to actually hear us engaged in a discussion about why things aren't functioning necessarily the way they should be with respect to our government and related systems. So with that, and we're also going to give you an opportunity to be engaged. So we're going to talk for a little bit, and then we want you all to interact with us and pose some questions and share some of your thoughts as well. I'm just going to do a brief introduction of all of my fellow panelists here, because you have a wonderful set of bios in front of you or that you had earlier today in your packet, so I urge you and encourage you to read those. But for now, I'll just give you what I like to call the elevator speech about why each of them is great. So to my far left is Sean Wilentz. Sean is a professor at Princeton University, and his background is focused on history. So he is going to bring to bear on this conversation an historical perspective about how we got here and why our system of government is not necessarily functioning the way we think it should. And is this the first time this has happened? Is there a pattern in practice, as lawyers like to say, that has led us to this point? And what can history teach us about what we should do to make things better? To my immediate left is Brooke Gladstone. Many of you know Brooke's voice if you're an NPR junkie like me. She is host of On the Media on NPR, and she's going to share with us her perspective on the media and media polarization and what role the media actually plays in how we talk about these issues and frankly, how citizens think about these issues. To my right is Diane Stewart. Diane is the president and CEO of Public Works. And she's really going to talk to us about the mindset of the public and how people become civically engaged. And what does that mean with respect to how they care about these issues or don't care about these issues, or what we can do to get them more concerned about these issues. And finally, to my far right is Rehan Salam. Rehan is a writer for the National Review, and he's a senior fellow at R Street Institute. And he is going to talk to us about diversity and how diverse cultures and backgrounds and the fact that our country has changed in terms of our population and how it's become much more diverse and how that mixing of different perspectives has helped to change our system of government and how it functions and how we think about it and how we become engaged. So with that, I'd like to start the conversation. Each of you has a microphone in front of you. So, Sean, let me start with you as the historian. How did we get here? you know, we all know this is not something new. Right. We've seen issues like this. And I will tell you from an historical perspective, you know, as the director of the Washington office for Brennan, I spend a lot of my time on the Hill. And I have to tell you, when I'm up there talking about our issues, one of the things that I hear so often is, it didn't used to be this way, Nicole. Right. You know, too bad you're right. too young, which I still like to hear. Too bad that you're too young to remember the days right. when Republicans and Democrats right. would fight during the day, but they'd right. go to Sam and Harry's at night right. and they'd figure it all out. And right. the next day it would be all better. How did we get here? Right. And why don't right. things still work that way?
The old bar. Well, I mean, the good news is that we've been here before, actually. And the bad news is that we've been here before. The idea of American politics being consensual or you know, cordial, really is a myth. I mean, there was a time, there have been times when that's true. The 1950s was one of them. There was a broad agreement on foreign policy, for example. Which wasn't going to be true later on, coming out of World War II. There were a lot of ways in which that was an abnormal era. So that the nostalgia for the old days is for an old days, but it's not generally true for American history. But what we're seeing today, I think, there's a lot of ways that historians can look at this. Historians can look at anything anyway, you know, a million different ways. But there are two big ones. One is that much like, well, twice in American history this has happened, there was a political party generally thought of as the more liberal political party, which was based on an alliance between northern liberals and southern racists. The Democratic Party of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson, right? The slaveholders of the South and the plain Republicans of the North. That held together for 30, 40 years, and then bang, the slavery issue intervened. Politics took a whole, went out of control, and we had a civil war. We didn't have a civil war the second time. But we're living with its effects, which is we had a Democratic Party that came out of the New Deal. That was the Liberal Party of the North plus the Jim Crow South. And then came the Civil Rights Movement, and boom. And we're still living with the consequences of that in large degree. And a lot of the politics we think of as the politics of cultural, you know, the culture wars, et cetera, that really comes out of a lot of that. The other point, though, I think that has to be made is there have been times in American history when small groups of fairly dogmatic forces in American politics really have become more powerful than not. That happened in the 1850s when the slaveholders ran the Democratic Party. The Goldwater era, to a certain extent, the McCarthy era. Today, I think, and I don't know if is Nora Ornstein in the audience? Is he here today, tonight? Well, okay. Basically, I have, you know, he said everything I have to say. So you know, I can just sort of back off. If you, the book that he wrote with Thomas Mann called It's Worse Than It Looks kind of gets into all of this, which is that what we're talking about today, I think, historically, is less a matter of polarization than a matter of radicalization and how one part of the Republican Party has grown more radical over time. And it really goes back to the 1980s. But you can chart it. You can see it, how it's happened. And the politics that we have, the acrimony that we have, is less, you know, the reason that people cannot get together for a drink afterwards is because people don't recognize each other as living on the same planet. And that's because of the radicalization, I think, of the Republican Party, which began in the aftermath of the Reagan presidency. And I mean, I can give a whole long story about all of that. But I think that's the way we have to look at it. And if we approach it that way, it's not to say that all the other things that you're talking about, you've been talking about, are not important. You know, gerrymandering is important. Filibustering is important. All those structural things are important. But they achieve importance, I think, at least in trying to figure out where we are, with this larger political fact, this larger historical fact. I mean, you can't divorce structure from the actual politics. And the actual politics, I think, that's what you see looking at it historically.
Next, but I have one question for you. You talk about the fact that within the Republican Party there's this divide,
uh-huh.
but we've seen that before, but the after effects necessarily haven't been the same. Like, for instance, you know, I remember you know, in the 90s when uh-huh. I worked for a state legislature, and the Democratic Party, the centrists, were really
right.
You know, people were taking note of the centrists, and there was a division between the centrists within the Democratic Party and the more progressive part of the Democratic Party, but we didn't see the same kind of manifestations resulting from that. Why is that any different?
Well, and there still are divisions in the Democratic Party. But I think the difference is actually, look at this week, what's happened this week. You had a deal whereby the budget will no longer be held hostage, considered a big deal. But you still have the question of immigration. And the Speaker of the House of Representatives came, proposed some principles for immigration reform. His caucus said, get lost. And then he blamed it on the president. That is a dysfunctional. That is beyond dysfunctional. That's not people getting together. That means that the party has the tail is wagging the dog. And I think that's what we saw, what we've seen, really, ever since the midterms, is watching that happen again and again and again. I had thought that division, that breach was being overcome. And that's why what happened this week was, to me, quite significant that it hasn't been overcome.
Since we started talking about history, and you heard mention of the Civil War, and that brings up race and all kinds of other differences, tell us why the change in the diverse makeup of this country, how that's perhaps impacted what we're seeing and what we're dealing with, and how the public reacts to the dysfunctional parts of our government.
I should stipulate first that I guess I have a somewhat different view of what happened, for example, most recently with this imbroglio over immigration. One way of looking at it is that there was a time when the Chamber of Commerce and John Boehner and a relatively small group of people could kind of determine the direction of the party. And now that is much less likely to be the case. There were certain claims that were advanced by the Gang of Eight, the folks who prepared the Senate immigration bill, that have been contested, vigorously contested. Many of those claims were actually don't think very reliable. And I think that, that is a kind of disempowerment of a kind of elite group that you've seen happen in lots of different societies. I sometimes like looking at this in comparative terms. My family is from South Asia. They're, South Asian Muslims. And if you look in India, you hear very similar parallel laments when people talk about contemporary Indian politics. They'll say that, kind of contemporary politics, it's so much more populist and awful in various ways. And part of that is a reflection of the rising assertion of a wide variety of social groups. For example, caste politics are a much bigger part of Indian life. I mean, people who just kind of weren't really engaged in the conversation, we now hear them a lot more actively. They're able to, they have independent channels through which they can reach the wider public. And they're quite comfortable asserting themselves in that way. So I think that, to go to your original question, I think that the way that I sometimes think about it, so first of all, there is a piece of the changing composition of the population and cultural diversity. There's also what we might call normative diversity. So, Sean is a historian. He knows a heck of a lot more about this than I do, but he recently wrote an article about a guy some of you might have heard of called Edward Snowden. Now, Edward Snowden is not just known by the kind of people in this room. His name recognition in the United States is extremely, extremely high. You might have also heard that Microsoft Research recently did a little study which found that only 4% of adults in this country read 10 news articles and 2 opinion articles a month. Yet Edward Snowden's name ID is way, way higher than that. You might have also heard of a former governor of Montana, a guy named Brian Schweitzer, who is thinking pretty seriously about running for president. He's certainly telling anyone who will listen that he intends to run for president. And, he's a quirky guy who wears a bolo tie and sort of much else. He favors Medicare for All. He's a very interesting, quirky Democrat who might go very far. He's also someone who is very forcefully and explicitly said that he believes that Edward Snowden merits a pardon and that he is, in fact, a hero. Now, for a certain people who belong to an older generation, let's say, or I shouldn't even say older, but, who belong to a certain different kind of, let's say, nationalist sensibility or, politics sense of the water's edge kind of sensibility, that would be just absolutely shocking. It would be thought of as kind of utterly politically suicidal. And again, this is not happening, in the fever swamps of the right or whatever else. I mean, this is someone who is very much in the mainstream of the Democratic Party conversation. And I think that, normative diversity, the fact that we have, really meaningfully clashing worldviews, we've had that before in our history. But I think that you actually see this manufacture of new kind of political sensibilities happening much more rapidly now. And I think this is something that you're seeing happening not just in the United States, but around the world. I mean, there's more to say about that, but, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Diane, let me ask you this. Rehan just mentioned that really startling statistic about how little Americans read about what's going on, and which leads me to believe that we're not doing a good job keeping up on public affairs, what's going on, and even what's going on with our government. What is the role that citizens really play in changing this problem we have with government dysfunction? Is there something that the citizenry can be doing and should be doing to help push change in a different direction?
Well, I think that one of the things that that's a little hard to get our minds around is that we tend to think about how citizens get engaged in terms of activism. And you know, the vast majority of human beings do not have time to be activists. So then the question is, what is the role of, you know, how do you get a citizen to really see themselves as having some meaningful stake in what's happening with government? Because until you can get citizens to see that there's something that will benefit their community in public systems, or that some government entity can actually make quality of life better in their state, there is that you really can't engage with people in the way that we have to be able to engage with people. My organization did a series of very intensive research, multidisciplinary research, that really probed for how do people think about this thing called government? What is it that they see it and understand about it? And the first answer is they don't think about it much at all, really. When they do think of it, they tend to think of partisan wrangling, and that's been the case for a while. If they think beyond that, it's very hard for them to think beyond that because that's all they really see. So they never really get to see what government is and does and why it exists to begin with and why we elect these people to go someplace and begin to think about what needs to be happening in our country or in our state or in our city. But if they get beyond that, then what they think about is just, you know, law, that's bureaucratic and possibly corrupt, but they don't have any sense of what that is. And then the next thing that they might think about is that they might benefit from government, but usually they think someone else benefits from government. And truly, one of the huge tasks that I think we have, if you want people to have a sense of ownership, and if you want people to see the need for reform and to see even the possibility for reform, I think that you have to get people into a citizen mindset where they see that these things are important to their lives. And there are ways to do that. And we've been experiencing that around the country at a fairly retail level. But we have to take that to another level. It's got to really go to scale where we engage people in understanding why they should care. Because until we do that, I think that we will have a hard time accomplishing reform itself.
Let me ask you this, though. Can we possibly build, are there some foundational things we can build upon? For instance, people understand the role of government when it comes to the fact that, like we're dealing with now in Washington, there's been a lot of snow and ice, and there's a lot of potholes. For instance, people understand it's my government that fills these potholes. People understand if I need a stop sign put at the local school near my kids, it's my government that I've got to lobby and get them to install that stop sign. Can't we build upon kind of these basic understandings of how government works for us and how people get engaged in government to then get people focused on some of the bigger issues?
I think you absolutely can. The hard thing is that many of the things that we want to see government do happen at a very sort of ethereal level, and they are not as concrete to most people as a pothole. But on the other hand, it is entirely possible to bring people to a place where they can think as a citizen and say, I can see we have to have all of this working well for us, that we have to aspire to it being what we need it to be in order for us to have the country we want to have. You have to connect those dots for people, though, because it's not necessarily obvious, and there are ways to do that, but it is that has to be part of our task as we're addressing all of the issues that you've been talking about today.
The media. Ooh, the media. That's such a loaded word. What role does the media play in all of this? I mean, because frankly, you know, the media helps us to figure out how we formulate thoughts about things and helps to sometimes persuade how we view things. What's the role of the media in all of this? And is there a role for the media to play in helping to reform our government so that it is functioning better and so that Americans become more engaged in helping it to function better?
You know, I wish. I don't think that's the way the media work. I mean, partly it's because we are so engaged in our own notions of what is balanced and fair and objective. And I just wanted to bring my favorite quote. In 1896, Adolph Ox bought the New York Times. One of the earliest best expressions of journalism's highest ideals was in his editorial. Everybody knows this. It will be my earnest aim that the New York Times give the news impartially without fear or favor, regardless of party, sector, interest involved, and so on. But if you go on and read the rest of the editorial, he says, nor will there be a departure from the general tone unless it be to intensify its devotion to the cause of sound money and tariff reform. So even when you're talking about the ultimate best example of objectivity, to him that was a found truth. That was a nugget of truth. It wasn't an opinion. And that's how we all are. A lot of people, there's a big debate over the push and pull of the media. Do the people and inform where the media go, or do the media decide where the people will go in their terms of, in their opinions? And I didn't want to come out with my usual stuff, so I did some research this morning, and that's why I brought paper. Don't worry, I'm not going to give a speech, but I found this interesting fact. When cable television entered American homes way back when, the likelihood that the residents would vote diminished. But that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is that this happened before there were cable news channels. Essentially, since 1980, about 25 million people have stopped watching the news. And the reason is entertainment. They are really not engaged, which speaks to Diane's point. They don't really care. And that the people who do watch cable news are pre-decided. They're finding a place that certainly parrots back what they want to hear, and you also have this thing called incestuous amplification, where if you're in that kind of an echo chamber, your views tend to get more extreme, as Cass Sunstein has said. But fundamentally, these people are the converted. So if we're talking about the vast majority of people, because only, I think it's 2 million people watch the evening news on Fox, a little less than a million on CNN, a little less than that on MSNBC, and about a million on PBS NewsHour. So that's 5. Out of, you know, endless numbers of people who really don't give a crap. And so the question, the big problem, isn't polarization, that intensifying loathing for each other, it's disengagement. And if you're worried about what the media's role ought to be, it really needs to be to get the disengaged to listen to some news. I mean, one of the people who did the studies that I quote from said that, would it kill the cable news channels or the networks or the entertainment shows to stick in 2 minutes of news somewhere so that people who don't want to hear it get the accidental encounter, which they used to get all the time before this age of choice, but now they don't. So the biggest problem isn't that they're deeply partisan, although those partisans have disproportionate impact because they're active and they're out there and we know who they are. But because the vast majority of people, those people who have turned off the news, tend to be moderate. That's what the studies show. And so, you know, there was a study by this guy, Marcus Pryor, who is at Princeton. He said that the biggest problem is that the median voter has never been so bored.
Go ahead and respond. I have a question, but go ahead and respond.
Well, I would just like to say that I think that that's a very, very important point. And I think that there's actually something that's kind of interesting. I know there's been a lot of talk about polarization today. Unfortunately, I missed a lot of that talk, but I saw from the writings that that was going to be on the agenda. I think in some ways that the extremes that we're seeing, and particularly in the things that I pay attention to, the extremes about the role of government, where there is the rogue members of Congress, the rogue political activists, who in some ways are basically saying, it's just fine if we sink this ship. It's just fine if we let these basic institutions that are our government, that are the way we do our business, fail. That is a very rogue kind of position. And even you see some of the split within the Republican Party that has to do with the recognition of that and then wanting to disown them. But I think that's an opportunity, because what the concern is not so much, to me anyway, what's happening in the Republican Party, what's happening among the parties, as what's happening ideologically, and whether there's an opportunity to step into that and say, this is irresponsible, and this is unpatriotic, and this is about basically tearing down the institutions that we should be proud of, and that we've been proud of being sort of a model for the world. And that is a way for us, I think, to begin to make the ideology the problem, not the people, and to then get to some of those moderate people who are disgusted, but they're also desperate to see a sign that these institutions have worth and are worthy of really being supported and saved and reformed.
Well, Steve, Brian makes an interesting point. Historically, when we've seen parts of our history where ideology is the problem and not the people, isn't that usually a catalyst for people to become more engaged and to actually rise up? And if so, why isn't that happening right now?
It can be, but it depends on whether people think that they can make a difference. I mean, during periods when one party, or in areas of the country where one party is so dominant, then you find participation just falls off. People just don't care. It's in those places, it's in those times when you think that, in fact, the contest is real, that the contest over ideology, you might actually make a difference in your locality as well as nationally. That's when people tend to get more engaged. And there is this waxing and waning. The difference, though, that I think that Brooke is pointing out, and I think it's vital, is that we now have forms of entertainment which are not about being involved or not being involved. It's about being opting out of the entire system. It's what de Tocqueville actually talked about. It's the great danger of individualism, which is what you opt out of everything. And it's not that you don't, you can't come back. You're gone for good. And your kids are going to be gone for good. And that, I think, is a media problem that is of enormous, that is very different from anything we've seen before. I'm afraid with that I have to take off because I'm due downtown. But I think history's been covered. Yeah? Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Wow, I didn't think you could do that.
I know. He's kind of ducking out for the hard questions. Brooke, Steve just mentioned it, and you mentioned it. This whole thing that, the citizenry is not, they're bored. They're not interested. They want to be entertained. So that leads me to, we've all heard this statistic about how most people of a certain age in America get their news from Colbert. They get it from The Daily Show. We all kind of laugh at that, but is there something there? Is there something to that? Does that mean that perhaps the way in which we engage the public needs to change and such that we meet them where it matters?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, there's the Project for Excellence in Journalism and Pew and the other people that are very interested in the state of journalism today will say that the public will tune in to news if it's done well. We have a way of consuming information and producing information, and the serious newscasts can be resolutely not entertaining. Do I, as a bonafide member of New York Public Radio, advocate for, dumbing down the news? No. But, if you listen to public radio, that it is about stories. There are a lot of narratives, and when it's done well, when any news is done well, we were discussing this at our table, that you want to take the data and then you want to wrap it into a narrative so that people can respond to a person and not to a number. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Nick Kristof was, notes that, well, there's been this study that's been repeated several times of a poor boy and a poor girl who are very sick, and the ad goes, you know, $30,000 will save them, and people give a certain amount of money. But if you have one of those kids individually in the ad, they'll give twice as much. So it isn't that a million is a statistic. Two is a statistic. We need to connect with a single person. And so you just need to tell the news better, and people will care. I mean, the thing about Colbert and Stewart is that increasingly, I don't think this was as true years ago, the news is pretty accurate. The stories aren't told elsewhere. And frequently, they speak to a larger problem in the culture, or in the political structure, or in the economic environment. So they tell these funny stories about serious issues through anecdote. I mean, I wouldn't... frankly, I think that they are pointing the way to... I mean, that's not the way straight news ought to go. But there's something in that technique, not to mention getting into the archives of tape and holding public figures responsible for things they said 1 month, 1 year, 5 years earlier. Maybe you don't have to go back 10, but, you know, that sort of work that they do isn't being done elsewhere.
Chime in on this, and then we're going to open it up for the rest of you to join us, because I'm sure you have some interesting comments and thoughts. But as I'm listening to all of this, one of the things I keep thinking, that keeps going through my head, is generational differences. You know, what if anything is there to say about the generational divide and what the younger generations, and I forget what letter we're up to now. I think I'm an Xer. I don't know what's next. I guess Y was after, and what are we, the millennials? What role do they have to play in this? And is there something we can be doing to reach them such that we can change this paradigm?
Well, I'm sorry to say that I've disagreed with so much of what's been said before me that I just feel as though I ought to address it.
Please.
When I mentioned that 4% statistic, and then I mentioned that a huge share of the public knows who Edward Snowden is, my reaction to that wasn't that I'm so distressed that so few people read News and Opinion. Rather, it's that clearly people are getting news. They're getting certain kind of important, meaningful news that's connected to important, meaningful narratives. Brooke had mentioned, kind of these television programs, these satirical television programs, and kind of that they... I guess some think that they do a relatively good job of, authentically representing what's really happening in the country. It's funny because we had a little incident over the last 2 weeks in which Samantha Bee, tremendously talented woman, it turns out, interviewed this guy for about 4 hours, kind of in a rope-a-dope exhaustion strategy, until he said something that could be chopped in just such a way as to embarrass him, and then, kind of crafted it into, again, a wonderful, effective narrative that, suits a particular kind of worldview. But what I would say we have is an increasing sophistication around narrative as a technology. So people talk about the real economy and the virtual economy. Another way to think about it is, what do Chinese conglomerates buy from the West? They buy brands. They buy stories. So in a way, I think that it's less a matter of this distinct, hard distinction between a real and a virtual economy. It's kind of everything is the virtual economy. And so, and you are seeing this little mini new media gold rush that's happening right now. And I would suggest the reason you're seeing it is because people are starting to understand how important narrative technology is. So earlier on, we heard about the amount of money that is being spent, political campaigns, political advertising, et cetera. Now, when you compare it to the amount of money that's spent to market a product, to just kind of name anyone at random, it's actually quite modest. And so it's kind of interesting to think about it in that kind of context. And I think that, what's happening in media is that you're having a lot of people who are coming outside of traditional media who are actually much savvier about narrative as a technology and narrative as a business than people who are kind of inside of media. So, again, if you're living in a society with normative diversity, with people, and new communities are emerging all the time. So when we were talking about government before as community, one thing that's interesting is that I would really disaggregate what we mean by government. We're talking about, for example, there are a lot of people, including affluent suburbanites who kind of don't like paying high taxes, who don't like things like school vouchers as well. Now, why would that be the case? Part of it is because there are many public goods that are essentially kind of quasi-private goods, right? A school is, in a sense, a vessel of community-specific social capital. And so you're, you know, you might think, by buying a home, I invested in this community-specific social capital. And that's going to be very, very different from something like, I want to achieve some larger redistributive goal, let's say. You know what I mean? Government means a billion different things, and those things are certainly like a really like far different end of the spectrum. You can absolutely get people engaged, people who are not reading 10 news articles or 2 opinion articles a month or whatever else to care about, you know, these institutions that kind of directly materially impact their lives. But I guess sort of another question is, how do you get people to care about some of these larger normative questions, which frankly we disagree really, really deeply, and I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing. But you know, as to the generational question, I mean, you know, one of the things that I really care about and think about a lot is that I'm one of 35 million second-generation Americans in this country. There's another 13% of people who were born outside of the United States. This is an enormous group of people. Also, it's really bifurcated. There's a very big stream of these people who are extremely poor. You know, 9% of the population doesn't speak English extremely well. And that number has gone up in absolute terms, not in percentage terms, but by like 84% over the last 20 years. So, you know, and, you know, when people like me, that is conservatives who are kind of a little skeptical, of, let's say, about the Senate immigration bill, think about this stuff. We think about things like this community-specific social capital, you know, this kind of like the guts of this stuff. And there's a way in which this, the Snowden stuff to me is connected to this kind of moral cosmopolitanism that you see a lot in certain kind of communities like my community. But then you've got this other thing that's happening, and I think these conversations are very disconnected from each other, and I think people don't always think about, well, what does my moral cosmopolitanism mean in terms of really being able to forge a community at the ground level? And I think that these are questions that I think all of us, young people, old people, ought to grapple with more.
Two things about young people in relation to these questions. One is that I think that, if Felicia is still in the room, the Roosevelt Institute has a campus network that is across the country in dozens of colleges. And there is something really interesting happening there, where these young people came together and really and worked over a series of months to develop a document, or sort of a manifesto, it's basically about government by and for millennial America. And it really reflects, I think, the fact that there is an interest in among young people of a different sort than has existed perhaps in the last couple of generations to the degree that it's there. I think there's also interesting things going on, like with Code for America, where I believe it maybe was Daniel Stitt who said to me that he went to a Code for America event, and he saw, he felt that it was the most pro-American government gathering that he had ever seen. And it was, and I think that tells us something about the potential among young people. One of the difficult things is that the other thing we see is that there is such a little understanding among young people. The whole notion of citizenship, as people my age grew up with, it's really kind of faded from the consciousness of the country. And part of that is that civics has kind of regressed to learning how a bill becomes a law, as opposed to really having a sense of what our responsibility is to make our communities better. And but there's still, I think, there's a possibility of tapping into an energy around these questions that is aspirational among young people today that that may bode well.
Thank you.
May I, just for a second?
You know what, Brooke, yeah. I got to be the hatchet woman, because I know people are itching to ask questions. So maybe we'll figure out a way for you to get that into a response. I'm not sure how we're doing this. I think we have people with microphones around the room. Yes, we do. We have two people. So if you have a question or a thought, and I see Patricia first, can you just take the mic to them, and someone will come to you, and you can, and tell us if you're directing your question to a particular panelist.
Thank you. Patricia Bauman. Well, two words I have not heard: social media. And I think that we cannot underestimate the way in which people are increasingly communicating, not top-down, but horizontally among themselves about issues that they care about. Young people get their news, they communicate, they network. Social media plays an enormous role in how people think about issues and about democracy, how they participate, how they learn. Another thing that I would note is that many people become involved in government as it affects their lives. And I would point in particular to the widening gender gap. We see increasingly that women are becoming activated to become politically engaged because the lines have been so clearly drawn between the extremes of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. We haven't discussed that. It isn't on the agenda for this conference. But I don't think we can dismiss how strongly people feel about issues, whether it's immigration, whether it's poverty, economic inequality, a whole slew of women's issues, including economic inequality that women suffer from. So as we look at these issues, they don't exist in a vacuum. They really exist in people's lived experience. This is, I guess, a statement and not a question. And also, but I would like to know, particularly from you, how you think the media can work with the new channels of communication. They're, in fact, more lateral than hierarchical.
Well, how the media can work with them, that's what the media are, or what a big chunk of the media are. And it is certainly true that, and there are plenty of studies to back this up, that the more engaged one is online, the more active one tends to be in one's community. As a matter of fact, it's hard to know, though, whether it's that engagement online facilitates it, encourages it, or whether it just exists as an easier way to do what you were going to do anyway. The big debate is always, do the media, especially media that you carry in your pocket, that becomes part of your DNA, does that change you, or does it just make you more of what you already were going to be anyway? And most of the studies suggest that it's the latter, that those who are engaged and informed become more engaged and informed the more involved they are in their social media networks, and those who are disinterested have a perfect opportunity to place themselves into a walled garden where nothing untoward can ever penetrate, using the exact same technology and structures.
Next question.
Ryan. Ryan, you are one of the most prominent young conservative voices engaged in the debate in the conservative movement over what its future ought to be. As you might guess, earlier in the day today, in a variety of contexts, the conservative faction of the House Republican Caucus came in for some predictable thumping from some of us. I wanted to get your sense of, first of all, what you think the future ought to be for the conservative movement in this effort to make the system work, but also how the demographic changes you describe intersect with that. There's a kind of I think, probably a significant misimpression that demographic changes inevitably have one or another ideological consequence, and you've written quite a bit about why that isn't necessarily the case.
Oh, well, we have someone here at the conference, Jamal Bowie, who's written very intelligently about these subjects. It's really noteworthy that, you know, Mitt Romney won a bigger share of the non-Hispanic white vote than Ronald Reagan did in 1984. So, candidate a lot of people consider relatively mediocre, you know, kind of won a pretty big slice of this vote, and it seems not unreasonable to project that, you know, Republicans might win a larger share still, a larger supermajority of that slice of the population in the future. So I think that, you know, sometimes some of the claims made, oftentimes actually by you know, elite Republicans or establishment Republicans, whatever you want to call them, about demographic doom, I think are a little bit overstated because there's some more subtlety to this. Similarly, when you look at Latino voters, for example, really their income predicts their voting patterns quite well. So they might skew a little bit more Democratic at higher income levels, et cetera, but that's, you know, kind of one thing that's pretty solid. So if you see some level of upward mobility, and by the way, you might not, I mean, you know, depending on what will happen in the economic future. But I think that, you know, one thing that was really interesting, so I'm extremely optimistic, actually, probably irrationally optimistic, because I think that, you know, I'm part of a group of people that's getting bigger all the time that was kind of tending a garden that was, you know, not bearing much fruit and has been recently. And what's been surprising is that Heritage Action, a group that is probably not terribly popular in this room, and sort of, you know, and I certainly think that they haven't done things kind of terribly intelligently all the time myself, they actually had a summit on Monday, and, you know, I know this conference is off the record, but, you know, they were actually saying that what we need now is a positive affirmative agenda. And this is actually becoming kind of commonplace. There are a lot of people who are saying this, and actually some of the people who are doing the most interesting, creative policy work addressing problems like, stagnation, immobility at the bottom of society, criminal justice reform, a wide range of issues that, you know, kind of a lot of people on the right have cared about for a long time but haven't really found much voice for. These are people on the far right of the political party, or at least people that we situate that way. And people are coming up with a kind of new synthesis. So the idea is that, you know, there's a kind of transactional politics that had become very entrenched in kind of elite Republican politics. And then there was this kind of upsurge of energy that was kind of opposed to that transactional politics that was more ideological. Now, it turns out that ideological thing is actually evolving in some kind of surprising directions. Some of you might have heard that Ted Cruz has joined Rand Paul and Mike Lee in calling for criminal justice reform and sentencing reform, and, among other things. You know, you kind of have this greater expectation that, well, you know, put up or shut up, we need to actually offer distinctive alternatives. But the thing is that Mitch McConnell isn't going to do that. You know, and Mitch McConnell has different imperatives. He operates in a different kind of way. And I think that it's actually going to be some of these people who come out of this fever swampy, more kind of ideological kind of space, who are the ones who are actually open to this, partly because they feel a more organic connection, I would argue, to some of the people who didn't turn out to vote in 2012. Now, there's some dispute about this, but, you know, some people say there are 7 million non-college-educated white voters who did not turn out in 2012, who, sort of like many of whom did turn out in 2008. Now, that number's in dispute, you know, because we don't know exactly what it is. But, you know, the idea that, gosh, there's this constituency out there, and this kind of more transactional Republicanism didn't connect with them. Then there was, you know, kind of this Tea Party moment where it was not something that, frankly, didn't really kind of speak to some of these anxieties and concerns either all that well. And I think that we are seeing a new synthesis now, and I personally feel pretty optimistic about it.
Do we have another question? Yes, I see the hand here. Michael, thank you.
This is just one for Brooke. Actually, Brooke, because you quoted Ox earlier, I'm going to pull out this thing that I always keep in my wallet. My father worked at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch for 20 years. And carved on the wall of the lobby of the Post-Dispatch was this wonderful quote from Joseph Pulitzer, which, as you can see, is terribly tattered. But I want to ask you if you think this could sell today in the media. I've often read this and considered it to be more almost like a prayer. Always fight for progress and reform. Never tolerate injustice or corruption. Always fight demagogues of corrupt parties. Never belonged to any party, always opposed privileged classes and public plunderers, never lacked sympathy with the poor, always remained devoted to the public welfare, never be satisfied with merely printing the news, always be drastically independent, never be afraid to attack wrong, whether by predatory plutocracy or predatory poverty. I have to believe in my heart of hearts, as an American and as someone who cares about the news and the media and democracy, that that moral-driven mission could sell again if certain outlets just stood up for it and made it very, very clear that that was their mission. And I want to know whether or not you think that could sell again.
Again? I don't think it's ever sold, and I don't think Pulitzer followed it either, although it is a lovely, lovely sentiment. In terms of not being a member of a party, I'm actually one of those people who think that in these days of links, you can you can cleanse yourself with disclosure rather than merely the appearance of objectivity. You cannot belong to a party, but that doesn't mean you suspend your judgment. I mean, there was this belief that journalism, at least among certain precincts of journalism, that they were all passionless priests going about their business. I don't think, and there's nothing dispassionate about the statement you just read. I mean, Pulitzer felt very, very, I mean, he did have a pro-poor working class agenda, because those were his peeps. That's who he was selling that paper to, and he may very well have felt it very strongly. But there is no way you can be all those things and be a human being. I think that fundamentally, if you say, would it sell to have a progressive publication or a regular source like the Muckrakers did in the times of Teddy Roosevelt? Sure, I think that's already beginning to emerge. But to place the definitions on it, no party, just to pretend that you aren't part of the world that you're reporting on in one way or another, I don't know that that's ever worked, and I don't know that it ever can.
With that, before we close, because this is what's always so hard about these discussions, I think we could keep talking for a few more hours, but Diane... since there was not a question specifically for you, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to share a final parting thought, if you have one.
Well, my final parting thought would be that the reforms that we're here to talk about are absolutely crucial. I also think that it's true that the reforms, without really trying to engage people in this country and help them understand the importance of the government reforming for the things they care about, doesn't necessarily get us what we are hoping for out of reform. And I think these things have to be working together.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking my panelists.